I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Ben Lerner joins me again. The distinguished author has just published a new novel, The Topeka School. The reviews for the book have been good. The New York Times Book Review hailed the book as, quote, a high watermark in recent American fiction, while the Washington Post's Ron Charles called it an extraordinarily brilliant novel. The book is set in Topeka, Kansas in the 1990s. Adam Gordon is a senior in high school who we also meet as an older person as the book shifts time periods. We meet his mother Jane, his father Jonathan, as well as another character named Darren. Through these four characters, we see America as it was in the 1990s, the embodiment of middle America, and how we've ended up with the contemporary America we're contending with, politically and otherwise. Through various themes like abuse, toxic masculinity, as well as class, we see how we got to where we are today. That's something me and Ben Lerner talk about in this conversation we taped just over a week ago while he was in Toronto for an appearance. He was first on the program when his last novel, 1004, was published. It was an internationally acclaimed book, as was his first, Leaving the Atocha Station. He is a distinguished professor of English at Brooklyn College and has been a finalist for the National Book Award in Poetry. He has received fellowships from the Fulbright, Guggenheim, and MacArthur Foundations. This new book is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Please welcome back to the Plant on the Line program, Ben Lerner. Professor Lerner, good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Pretty good, yourself?
Good, thank you.
Are you sick of talking about the book already?
No, I'm not really sick of it. I mean, it's a funny thing. Like, you finish the book and then you talk about it, and it's sometimes you don't feel like the person who wrote it anymore. So it's like as mysterious to me as it is to a reader. But I enjoy talking about it. I learn about it when I talk about it.
And what's it like when you talk to readers of not this book, because I'm sure a lot of people you talk to about the book now haven't read it, but they talk to you about other books that you've written, previous ones, and they have their own interpretation, say, about what you wrote, and they may not be the same things that you were thinking about when you wrote the books. I mean, is that interesting to you at all?
Yeah, it is interesting because I think you write in part to, I mean, like when you're writing, you of course have a set of conscious concerns and you're making a certain set of aesthetic decisions, but you're also doing all kinds of unconscious work that you only kind of re-encounter sometimes when it's made visible by other readers. So it feels, I mean, a work of literature is a collaborative thing, and it aspires to enlist the participation of a reader, so it can be really illuminating to kind of be reading the work along with other people.
Yeah. Now, the book, The Topeka School, that's your latest. The character of Adam, how would you describe him?
I mean, Adam in this book, he's you know, most of it, well, let me say I think there are kind of two Adams. There's the Adam who's a high school senior at Topeka High School in the class of 1997, who's kind of described in the third person in this book. And then there's this implied older Adam, who's kind of an adult, writing in the present, remembering his childhood, and remembering his childhood in part from his parents' perspective. So I would describe the younger Adam as kind of torn between two worlds. On the one hand, he's the son of these well-known psychologists. His mom's a famous feminist author. His dad's a kind of expert at getting lost boys to open up. And he's very much their son. He's like a very verbal kid. He's an aspiring poet. And on the other hand, he's trying to pass in this very macho world outside of his household. And he's kind of torn between those two worlds. On the one hand, trying to value his kind of household values. And on the other hand, trying to pass as a real man in a red state where expressing yourself, talking, unless you're talking trash, is often considered highly emasculating.
And his voice, I was going to ask where that comes from. Obviously, these things come from one's parents. But what we inherit from them may not necessarily be them. Yet at the same time, when we look at it closer, it obviously comes from them, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, I think this is a book that's in part about the genealogy of the voice that's writing it, and that the book is an experiment in thinking about how the voice is always this intergenerational composite. It's the voice of your parents or your grandparents or mass media or artwork or your peers or whatever. And Adam is kind of trying, the young Adam is kind of trying on different voices as an adolescent. And the older Adam is kind of looking back on his childhood, is trying to think about all the different influences in his voice, those he wants to honor, those he wants to edit out. And the book is also an experiment in kind of writing in the voices of one's parents and kind of ventriloquizing one's parents once you're a parent yourself and realize that your parents were just two other people who kind of didn't know what they were doing but were doing their best.
Yeah. There's this debating tactic that Adam, because for people listening, Adam is a debater in high school. This
right.
tactic of the spread. What is it?
Yeah.
And I mean, I didn't know what it was until I read it in the book and then read other things about it. I mean, now that I know what it is, it's awfully familiar to sort of the rhetoric we're hearing today.
Yeah. The spread, I don't know if there's like Canadian high school debate that has also been infected with this strategy, but The spread was this thing that happened in competitive high school debate where teams would try to make the greatest number of arguments as possible, because the idea was that if the other team failed to respond to an argument in the allotted time, they conceded the argument. And what this meant in practice was these adolescent kids speaking at like an unbelievably rapid rate, spit flying, like sometimes they would pass out. It was like a total jargon that was unintelligible to the uninitiated. Like it would look like some kind of glossolalic ritual more than it would look like argumentation. And Adam is both really kind of like disgusted by this practice, and also sometimes when he's participating in it, experiences this kind of poetic transport where he feels like he's no longer even in control of the language. It's just like pure sound and rhythm coursing through him. So the book wants to both be kind of critical of the practice and also see its glimmer of poetic possibility. It also wants to say that the spread seems really related to the kind of overloaded present where, you know, not only like the 24-hour news cycle or the fine print that's in, you know, a financial disclosure form, which is really an attempt to conceal information, not to disclose it or communicate it, or like the way in the U.S. that Trump has kind of learned this lesson, although he himself speaks very haltingly and agrammatically, he's learned this lesson that it's like if you have 1,000 scandals a day, you incapacitate the public. Like it's about a kind of overload and incapacitation. So yeah, that's one of the book's theaters of extreme speech, the spread that I hope also kind of resonates with the present.
Yeah, there's a moment in the book where you describe Adam, and you just alluded to this, that where he's no longer just giving a speech; the speech is giving him. You've experienced that as a debater, haven't you?
And as a writer, I think that's an experience, that experience of like language coursing through you, like you're not in control of the language so much as you're a medium for this social miracle that is language, I think is a moment of kind of transport and intensity that you can experience in lots of different domains. Sometimes it can be horrifying and depersonalizing, and at other times it can be inspiring and kind of refresh your sense of the social force of language.
How much did that happen to you as you were writing the Topeka School?
That's a good question. I mean, this was a hard book to write. It's certainly something I recognize from certain moments of writing where you feel like you're on a kind of autopilot.
Yeah.
Like you're not even making decisions. You're just figuring out a way to kind of transcribe some force that's moving through you. I mean, I think that happened a little bit in a strange way when I was writing the sections that are kind of in a version of my mother's voice. Like I felt more like I was taking dictation than that I was just having to make stuff up. But, you know, writing like 99.9% of the time, writing for me is like a pretty tortuous process. But then there are those moments of flow. And the experience of flow, I think, is always an experience of something bigger than yourself and your individual ego.
Now, you alluded to the character of Jane in the book, and she's resonated with a lot of readers. What was she like to write? You mentioned that, you know, that the character was based on your mother, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, on the one hand, like, writing in that voice, which I think is kind of a midpoint between my voice and my actual mother's voice, was, like, less about trying to imagine myself as some other person,
yeah,
and more about kind of drilling down on the way in which my own voice has been so influenced by my mom, who's also a writer.
Uh-huh.
But it was intense to kind of vent it, you know. There's something kind of psychically complicated and dangerous feeling about writing as a parent, you know, writing about your own parent, throwing the voice. Like, it's a kind of time travel, and it was really interesting, and it was kind of disorienting at certain moments.
Well, was writing Jonathan the same experience for you?
A little bit less, because Jonathan's voice in the book resembles my own father's voice less. It kind of sounds more like me. I mean, you know, like in the way that, like, Freud talks about in dreams, you're every person in the dream. Like,
yeah,
I'm kind of every person and no person in this novel.
Yeah.
But I think that the Jonathan character, I mean, he does resemble my actual father in certain ways. Like, his dissertation is my dad's real dissertation, or my dad did make some of the films that I kind of talk about the Jonathan character making. But it's a little bit more, it's just more me tonally, as opposed to actually trying to capture the different voice of a loved one. So it was, like, a little bit less psychically complicated. And also, it's a tougher experiment to change genders. You know, that's like a more interesting kind of experiment in ventriloquizing to a certain degree.
Well, that experience, though, of writing another gender, or one that you're not, is that, do you think more writers should do that? Because that's a question that a lot of people are talking about nowadays, not just in terms of your book, but
yeah,
sort of that appropriation of I guess, gender by some writers.
Yeah.
I mean, that's something that we're all contending
with. It's really complicated, yeah. Right. I mean, you know, so, like, in this book, even when, you know, the voice of Jane or the voice of Jonathan or whatever is at its most vivid, I think the goal of the book is to still keep the reader aware of the fact that these are the older Adam's reconstructions of those voices. These are acts of imagination. So some books, there'll be lots of different voices, and the goal of the book is to make you forget that you're reading and really believe that the writer has this perfect access to all these other minds. And in this book, it's a little different. In this book, the drama, the pathos, I hope, is actually in the effort of the son to inhabit these voices. And there are, like, tears in the voices, or moments where the representational machinery breaks down. And what I think is that novels are really good spaces, not just to imagine writing as an other, but also to dramatize the confrontation with your limits of access to others. That when novels are at their best is when they both make a bid to imagine other minds, but also to a certain degree respect the irreducible privacy of other minds. So I don't think it's ever as simple as, like, one writes as himself or one writes as another. I think what the novel is really good at is dramatizing the effort to imagine another and the way that gets stuck. That's not just, like, an easy gift of omniscience. That's actually, like, a messy, complicated struggle.
One of the other themes that you contend within the book is toxic masculinity, and it's fascinating to read about the rage that a character like Adam encounters, that he has himself sometimes. My parents are Filipino, so I'm not obviously white, and as I was reading the book, I was wondering about where this rage comes from, and I'm wondering, it obviously comes from the fact that Adam is searching for some identity or some place to fit in.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a lot less dangerous for someone not white as opposed to someone who is?
It's a good and complicated question. Yeah.
Because I guess we're all looking for our identity. And in Adam's case, the fact that he is white, I think, answers probably a lot of how complicated or how dangerous it is.
Yeah. I mean, you know, James Baldwin talked about the lie of whiteness and the lie of whiteness and the quote-unquote white community when Baldwin was discussing is that there's no such thing. Like, whiteness only means the historical privilege of not being marked with some other identity, right? It only means a kind of contentless historical power to differentiate yourself from everyone else and act like you have some position of universality or whatever. And what Baldwin talked about was that there's a terrible loss. I mean, not only, obviously, the horrible things that have happened because of racism, but that Baldwin emphasized, like writers like Fred Moten have emphasized more recently, the way that whiteness damages the privileged, too. And what he meant, right, was, like, he talks about, like, you know, that those, I might not get the quote exactly right, but in Baldwin's essay on being white and other lies, he talks about this paradox, and he says that those who believed that they could control and define black people divested themselves of the power to control and define themselves. Mm-hmm. That there's a kind of identity crisis specific to whiteness that has to do with having created an identity that's totally based upon the demotion of some racialized other or whatever. And that I'm trying to think through in this book, without pretending to have final answers, the way that there is a kind of imaginative poverty within the identity of the privileged, within the identity of these largely white middle-class kids, that has to be addressed. And if it's not addressed, what happens is it gets filled with appropriation, it gets filled with violence, xenophobia, misogyny, homophobia, etc. So I do think this is a book about one angle on that terrible paradox that Baldwin describes, and on being white and other lies.
And that's one review that I read of the book talked about how you illuminate this place, Kansas. You grew up in it, obviously. But it's a place that a lot of people haven't paid attention to, and it's got all these political and cultural contradictions that really confound the United States today. And I guess we're all, I guess, underserved by not having paid attention to that place.
Yeah, I mean, Kansas is a really, you know, Topeka is a really interesting place in particular because of these different worlds that coexisted in this small town. I mean, I definitely think that among the many forms of polarization that are, you know, current in American politics, and not only American politics, one form of polarization is the kind of heartland and the imagination of a coastal elite. And it's a myth, largely, but it's a powerful myth that's been instrumentalized by right-wingers in particular, and that I do think that, like, trying to understand some of the contradictions of the middle of the country is important. In Kansas, I mean, one of the really interesting things about Topeka is, like, all these writers who have come out of there. Like, it's a really rich place culturally, in addition to being a place that's really marked by American-style violence of a certain sort. I mean, when I left, it was like fourth in per capita homicide for reasons that nobody could really explain. Yeah. You know, so I think Topeka has this like mixture of cultural richness and extreme cultural poverty and violence. And by cultural poverty, I'm not talking about poor people. I'm talking particularly about the kind of cultural poverty of an American white middle class, which is true of a whole lot of places in the United States, and not just this one town to grow up in.
Yeah. When you write about this place in the 1990s, because those were your teen years, are you nostalgic at all?
Right. No, no, not really. I mean, I would say that, like, the thing that the book doesn't pursue, because it wasn't part of the kind of aesthetic truth of the book, is, like, I mentioned these writers from Topeka. Yeah. A lot of my closest friends and interlocutors are Topekans who I was getting to know, like, as a kid there. So it was, like, a really rich time, too. Those friendships and that, those, like, kind of possibilities of male sociality are not in the book, because that's not what the book is about. But nostalgia is I don't know if I feel nostalgia or not, but I think nostalgia politically is an incredibly dangerous and reactionary affect. I mean, nostalgia is what is this kind of nostalgia for an America that never existed is in part what motivates the racist regressions of, like, Trump supporters to make America great again stuff. And it's also, to a certain degree, I think, what's motivating some Biden supporters, where it's like, we just want, like, a better version of the father figure as opposed to Trump. Whereas, yeah, like, what I really think is that we have to develop a whole new political language, and we have to recognize the bankruptcy of the political language that's got us to this point.
And how much do you think class has what role does class have to play? Because, I mean, we talked a moment ago about having not paid attention to say, the middle part of America. We really haven't talked about class. And I say this as a Canadian, because I don't think we do this in this country either. Mm-hmm. We don't talk about how much class plays a part in how people view one another.
Yeah, I mean, it's totally crucial. And I think that, I think in this book, it's kind of interesting, because somebody was saying that there's one figure named Darren who's kind of more working class, or his family has less resources, who gets caught up in all this violence. And somebody was saying, oh, well, you're kind of implying that Trump supporters or whatever are all, like, poor and mentally disordered people. And in fact, I think the character in the book who most represents most represents the kind of proto-Trump figure is this guy who went to fancy Ivy League schools, who's this debate coach named Brian Evanson, who's in a similar class position as the Adam Gordon character, but who's really kind of, like, weaponized his eloquence in order to protect his privilege. I mean, there's no separating. I don't think there's any story. I'm a materialist. I don't think there's any story about any political moment that isn't a class story. Yeah. I think that to understand the way that a white supremacist rhetoric has been utilized, it's largely about rich white people motivating poor white people against an imagined enemy, like, you know, Mexican immigrants or whatever, in order to protect the class positions of the very wealthy and the symbolic capital of white people, especially after they suffered the neurological insult of an African-American president or whatever. So, every story is a story about class, but I think that class is often lived in different kind of modalities, and this is in part about a kind of sickness in, like, part of what this book is about is a kind of sickness at the heart of privilege and racial privilege and class privilege, which I think is harder to address, because I think it's easier to explain, like, violence when violence is happening amongst a materially impoverished community, because then we can tell a story about it in which they're crimes of economic desperation.
Yeah.
And I'm a little bit more interested in a kind of desperation that doesn't make any sense in terms of a narrative of economic deprivation. It has to be more with a kind of imaginative poverty. But that too is inseparable from class. And I think there's no such thing as a novel that isn't in part about class contradictions and how they're lived.
Yeah. There's a lot of talk from articles I've read about you and reviews of the book about this book in particular being, say, a bridge from one part of your career to another. Do you write a book? Do you write a book like the Topeka School with that in mind? Are you thinking about where you're headed as a writer as you're writing, say?
With this book, it was a little different in the sense that I wanted to finish what I kind of think of as a trilogy of the three novels, mm-hmm. and I wanted, you know, this is a book both about prehistory, about a family's prehistory, about the political prehistory of our moment, and I also wanted this book to function as a prehistory to the other two terms in the trilogy. So in this book, I was kind of conscious of how I both wanted to write something that would complete a trilogy, but I also wanted to do something as different as possible for myself, right? I wanted to stay, like, within the grammar of the other works, but to make it as, like, as big a change as I could. So there are multiple centers, there are multiple voices. It's not set in a cosmopolitan city. It's set more in the past. So this was, to a certain degree, you know, when I was finishing this book, I wasn't just thinking I'm finishing the Topeka School. I was thinking I'm finishing a trilogy of novels. So there were kind of different pressures. But I haven't the slightest idea what I'll do next. I don't even know if it'll be fiction, you know. And to a certain degree, like, I feel like that's all, you know, every time I finish a book, I feel like I'll never write anything again for a while. And I'm kind of in that moment. But I definitely feel like it was a trilogy and that I wrote this book to try to figure out what could be both the last term in the sequence and the first term, if that makes sense. Yeah. That it could be both the prehistory, but it could also be written from the perspective of an Adam in the present who's kind of, you know, after those other two books.
The other rap about you is that you've written a great deal. I guess you start from yourself and then you write outward. Having written, as you have in these three novels, aspects of yourself, I mean, you've obviously drawn from yourself or put yourself into these books. Does any of that lead to some introspection about who you are, and are you better for it, perhaps?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I don't know if writing makes you better. I mean, the self-reflection. I mean, I think the books. Well, it's a good question. I mean, I think that the movement across the three books is a movement about a kind of figure who's moving from a kind of like solipsism to a greater sense of interconnection and the possibilities of collective sincerity. And so I think that there is a kind of progress for the narrator in the books to a certain degree. The question about whether or not I can claim to have benefited from writing those books is an interesting question. I mean, being kind of self-aware, and the books certainly produce high levels of self-awareness, like, I think on the one hand, when you're writing about yourself, you're discovering things. On the other hand, I think you just always have blind spots, and the blind spots one has about himself are tremendous. So I think there's a way in which I can't really be a judge, but I do think there's something to be said for the project of investigating the history of one's own voice. Like, you know, right now, for example, when there's so much damaging and gross speech by a lot of white men in power, it's very tempting for a white guy to just disavow that and, you know, be for all the right things and against all the wrong things, uh-huh. and say I'm totally different from that. And I think the harder political project is to ask the question, you know, what part of Brett Kavanaugh's shrill indignation is in me? What part of this kind of authoritarian personality is in me, you know, like, to actually do the harder work for a white guy of trying to interrogate what aspects of his voice are borrowed from or indebted to traditions that need to be changed. So I guess what I'm trying to say is I think self-reflection is always a mode of social critique, because every individual is always a composite of all these different social forces.
Yeah. The other thing I was thinking about is people will read this book or your previous books, and they'll inevitably ask you, I'm sure you're asked this all the time, about how much of it is you. But at the end of the day, I mean, years from now, people wanting to get to know you, They'll certainly find aspects of you in these books, won't they? Or just the idea of understanding who you are, or where you came from, if you will.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the books invite that. I mean, I also think that, you know, even if you're writing a novel that's set, you know, you're writing like a sci-fi novel on another planet or whatever, you're still, I mean, the author is still discoverable in the work. You know what I mean? Like, you're always, you know, writing like any other art form is always like the individual in this wrestling match with the social medium of language. And what comes out is both personal and impersonal. That's kind of like true no matter what the content of the work is. But certainly a lot of the themes my books are invested in, you know, about like, you know, fraudulence or authenticity or the way that fact become, you know, the way that fictions are lived, or the way that what seems like is revealed to be a fiction, or the way a voice is an intergenerational technology or whatever. Those were all themes that for me benefited. I thought I could make more compelling artwork if I blurred some of the boundary between fact and fiction, because that's so thematically relevant to those concerns. But, you know, this sounds funny to say since I have written books that are involved with a kind of like avatar of myself, but like, I don't really think I'm that interesting. I mean, the books aren't a claim that this Adam Gordon character is particularly interesting. Hopefully the writing is interesting,
right,
and the record
right.
of consciousness
yeah.
is interesting. So, you know, ultimately where the books live or die doesn't have much to do with whether or not you're interested in this aspiring poet or whatever. It has to do with whether or not the prose feels alive and the patterning feels alive.
Yeah. It's been such a pleasure speaking with you today, Ben. I've kept you longer than I said I would, but I appreciate your time. Continued good luck with the book.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for talking.
The book is called The Topeka School. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Its author, Ben Lerner, joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.